Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and science writer Jonah Lehrer, no relation, joins me now. He's written a new article in this week's New Yorker about the problem of replicability in scientific research. It turns out that many of the things we thought we knew for sure are proving much less certain. Across a wide range of fields, from psychology to ecology, researchers are having trouble replicating the findings of groundbreaking studies, like the law of gravity, for one, and they're not sure why they're having trouble getting the same results. Maybe it's cultural, maybe it's natural, but either way, we have to question the idea, he says, that we can know for sure truths about nature. Jonah Lehrer is author of the books How We Decide, and Proust was a neuroscientist. He's also a contributing editor at Wired magazine, Scientific American Mind, and the NPR and WNYC, or the WNYC program, Radiolab. Jonah, welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks so much for having me.
The test of replicability is the foundation of modern science, modern research. But you say that even studies proving the law of gravity are hard to replicate. Gravity?
Well, it's not so much that gravity is hard to replicate. One can drop a ball and replicate the effect of gravity. It's that the particular equation of gravity seems to be a little bit imprecise and has repeatedly been off by anywhere from 1 to 2.5% in various experimental tests. So I don't hold up gravity as something we can't replicate. It simply gets back to the larger question of there seems to be some kind of difficulty in doing experimental tests of even the most sanctified equations and theories in modern science.
You start the article with a researcher named Jonathan Schooler, whose results were hard to replicate. Explain that study, what he found, and why this is symbolic of something bigger.
Well, the story of Jonathan Schooler really is kind of an emblem of the larger decline effect. In the early 1990s, Schooler made a big discovery in the field of psychology. It's called verbal overshadowing. It's a phenomenon where, you know, for centuries, we assume that when you repeat a memory, when you put that memory into words, you somehow strengthen the memory and solidify it. Schooler showed that the opposite often happened, and that the act of putting our memories into words, in a sense, threw them into the mental shadows and made it harder to remember the actual memory and could block all sorts of details. So it was a very big idea. It was a big finding, cited hundreds of times. But then Schooler ran into this kind of very troubling paradox, which is when a couple years later, when he tried to repeat the exact same protocol, he had real difficulty getting the same effect size, getting the same strength of the effect in his experiments, and it dropped by 30%. And then when he went back another couple years later, it dropped by another 30%. And sure enough, other researchers ran into the same problem. And he was very frank and honest, and I think brave, talking about how troubling it was for him as a scientist to think he discovered this big new fact, and then to felt like nature was taking the fact back from him. And so this has kind of led him on this quest to better understand the decline effect. And he's been very vocal, not only within psychology, but talking more openly about, you know, what are the implications for this on peer review, on the experimental process? Are there changes we should make to the scientific process as it currently exists to make the decline effect less likely to happen?
And we could give other examples, but we're not talking about squishy pseudoscience or anecdotal evidence here. You're talking about studies that meet the gold standard, randomized control science, things that are, you know, repeated enough times in the first place to be considered valid 95% of the time, et cetera, right?
These are findings that are in textbooks. These are drugs like second-generation antipsychotics, atypical antipsychotics, which are some of the most lucrative and widely prescribed drugs in the world. And these are the kinds of facts that are showing the decline effect. Even antidepressants. There's a forthcoming study by John Davis, which showed that, you know, brand name antidepressants, that the effect of these antidepressants has declined threefold in the last few decades. So these are not niche drugs. These are not kind of, you know, irrelevant facts. These are big ideas.
Another example you give is a study showing that females prefer to mate with males who are physically symmetrical. The study seemed to prove the notion that aesthetics are about genetics, a widely accepted idea. What happened when researchers tried to replicate that study? And what do you mean by physically symmetrical? Aren't all people, unless we've lost a limb or something, physically symmetrical?
Well, this is about the precise details of symmetry. So it turns out that there's this range of symmetry, and you can measure symmetry by simply measuring the digits on each of your hands and their differences. And so people show this, the standard bell curve of variation in terms of how symmetrical we are. And, you know, for a long time we've had this theory, Darwin's theory of sexual selection, that females choose male mates if they've got, you know, big peacock tails. But it was really about these arbitrary sexual symbols, and that's how we chose our mates, at least in the animal kingdom. In the early 1990s, researchers began thinking about, well, maybe symmetry is an actual cue, and because we know symmetry reflects the quality of your genes, people who, not so much people, but animals who in general have less mutation in their genome are more symmetrical, then maybe females are actually using this very kind of scientific metric to choose their male mates. And so this became a big idea. It actually helped overturn some of Darwin's ideas. And then the theory, which looked so robust at first, you know, the first 12 studies all confirmed it, then it started to fall apart. And so this theory of fluctuating asymmetry is often used as a case study in a sort of paradigm shift and how scientific paradigms work and unfold. So at first, everyone has an incentive to confirm the result, right? Here's this big, sexy new idea. All the journals want to publish results to show this idea is true. And then a couple years go by and the academic incentives shift, where now it's actually bigger news to disprove it, to not confirm it. And so you get these, you know, very fleeting fads where, you know, hot new idea, it's great to show it's true, and then all of a sudden it's great to show it's not true. And so that's why within 5 years, the vast majority of studies were showing that actually fluctuating asymmetry doesn't exist.
Are you suggesting that once a phenomenon is publicly accepted, that our behavior actually changes and therefore makes the initial results less likely to be replicated?
Well, you know, that could be driving it in certain fields. So in psychology, some of the psychologists I talked to mentioned that, you know, they think it's harder to find effects because don't forget that some of their subject populations are undergrads taking Psych 101. So maybe they've just learned about priming and you're trying to test priming on them. So it could actually be that our knowledge of the fact that they are in textbooks, makes it harder to verify variations on that. It could also be, for instance, one thing some clinical trials researchers mentioned in terms of why the effects of drugs are declining. They talked about actually what's happening is that drug advertising has convinced the public that drugs really work. And so part of the decline in the effect size is actually placebos are getting more effective, that people have been so persuaded by all the ads we see on television that you give us a sugar pill and that becomes more effective. And so then the drug placebo difference, which is really what we're trying to measure, begins to shrink. So in some ways, it is our knowledge of the world which might be influencing these results. But in many cases, you know, when you're measuring a fluctuating asymmetry on a small bird's feathers, that's probably not the case.
We have a few minutes left with science writer Jonah Lehrer, who writes in The New Yorker this week about the surprising difficulty of replicating scientific research. Any scientists listening right now? We just have a few minutes for calls. But scientists, have you run into this yourself? Do you, in a way, wind up baffled by the scientific method that you thought was rock solid? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, especially if any scientists, and maybe you read the New Yorker article by Jonah Lehrer on this week, want to chime in on this from your experience in the lab or whatever. 212-433-9692. And Jonah, you're right at the end that just because an idea is true doesn't mean it can be proved. I think we've known that. And just because an idea can be proved doesn't mean it's true. That's the one that's going to make people sit up and say, what? Because an idea is proved doesn't mean it's true? Isn't that what proof is?
Well, I think that's the troubling implication of some of this work on the decline effect, which is that here are ideas we thought we had proved. Here are ideas which have been enshrined in the textbooks. And yet now we can no longer prove them. It's this odd empirical purgatory where they're true and yet unprovable. And so I think this just raises questions about, you know, are there ways we can improve the peer review process? Are there ways we can make replication more trustworthy? I think the real takeaway of the article is not that we should abandon all scientific facts, or that, you know, we should not worry about climate change or all revert to creationism. That is not a takeaway at all. Instead, what I think it reminds us is that science is a human pursuit, that scientists are human beings, and that science is really, really hard. It's not easy. And that I think sometimes we often have this naive view that we simply do an experiment and then the truth is out there waiting to be discovered, and it's very easy to find. But I think what the decline effect really demonstrates is it's very, very difficult. And so to the extent we can put in reforms that make these unconscious biases harder to, less likely to influence the results, I think that's an important step.
Ken on our comments page writes, maybe I'm missing something, but isn't this one of the great strengths of science? If we discover that something we thought was true maybe isn't, doesn't that lead to greater discovery?
Absolutely. I think the fact that science accepts no settled truths is its great virtue. I think it gets more troubling when we thought we were doing rigorous experiments numerous times, and often these experiments, these studies, have led to billions of dollars in spending on various drugs, that they've influenced medical treatments. And so I think it's troubling the fact that we thought they were true numerous times. And this isn't 16th century experiments. These are experiments done last year, done 5 years ago. And now, for reasons we can't understand, they are no longer verifiable. I think that's the troubling aspect. But I think the larger point, the fact that science is always revising itself, really gets to the heart of why science is so important, why it's, you know, the foundation of modern civilization.
Ed in Huntington, you're on WNYC. Hi, Ed.
Hi, good morning. Werner Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, basically in particle physics, the fact that you're studying them alters their behavior.
Right, the famous Heisenberg, yeah. Is it, uncertainty principle? The fact that you're observing something alters its behavior. Do you think that that's in play here?
It's probably not in play. I mean, as seductive as that analogy is, most of the people I talked to thought it wasn't in play in fields like psychology or ecology or in these clinical trials. That seems to really be, you know, only a valid explanation at the subatomic level when it comes to experimental results. That said, I think the metaphor is really interesting to think about how the act of trying to observe something does change all sorts of other things at work in the world. And so, you know, you can talk about it not in terms of the movements of electrons, but in terms of biases and academic incentives. So in a very real way, we are not objective creatures. We can't simply go out there and just observe with a blank mind.
So another possibility.
We have a troubling tendency to see what we want to see.
On that point, I think, Greg in Forest Hills. Greg, you're on WNYC.
Yes, great article. And you bring up the antipsychotics. I mean, I'm a researcher, and the influence of drug companies on research is enormous. You have bipolar, where lithium is a gold standard. 70% have a response rate. But AstraZeneca will fund a study with Seroquel against lithium, provide lithium at a subclinical dose, and prove that Seroquel is more effective than lithium. What this means is very few patients who have bipolar will ever get to use lithium or Tegretol or Depakote.
Greg, I'm going to leave it there for time. But, Jonah, I think there are two layers to that question. One is, you know, obvious drug company pressure on science, do things in a way because we're paying for this study so it comes out our way. But another would be the more subtle thing that maybe you're writing about in this article, where just knowing that the drug company is funding you, even doing what you think is a perfectly honest study, might wind up affecting the results?
Yeah. So I would actually think when you look at the literature, it's the second possibility you mentioned, which is the most troubling, because this really gets back to the fact that we're not even aware that the fact that we're being funded influences our observations, but various meta-analyses have shown that it does time and time again. Another, even third troubling way that I think the funding of research affects the research itself gets back to what many researchers have identified, which is that drug companies also, when they fund clinical trials, if they don't get a result they like, they just don't publish the clinical trials. And so you see this is part of a larger flaw called selective reporting, where you see these holes in the literature where you'd expect a random scattering of results, but instead you just find positive results. And that just shouldn't happen given the way experiments are supposed to unfold. So I think there's a troubling tendency, too, to not just the fact that the money isn't just influencing what researchers find, but it's also influencing what gets in the literature. And because so many of our decisions are based on reviews of the literature, that really does affect our clinical decisions.
There was that headline last week in the newspapers that said researchers found an arsenic-eating microbe, and arsenic replaced one of the other basic, what we thought were necessary building blocks of life. And so the study redefined life as we know it, which, we're running around talking about Sarah Palin. Meantime, life is being redefined. but that study was met with a lot of skepticism. Do you think that journalists should stop saying studies show and things like that?
Well, I think the
media...
And we
have 15 seconds, Jonah.
I think the media does play a role in it. I think it's important to be skeptical, but be skeptical of the right kind of science. My problem is that we spend so much time wasting breath on, people who are denying rock solid science when in fact there's lots of science that needs to be questioned that would benefit from skepticism, but we're just not asking the right questions.
All right. Fascinating article in The New Yorker this week on the surprising difficulty of replicating scientific research by science writer Jonah Lehrer. I wish we were related because you're really smart.
Me too.
Thanks for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC.